Welcome to the House Republican Legislative Podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler. I'm your host, Chuck Nichols. Brian, here we go on our inaugural long-format podcast, an opportunity to explore ideas and legislation in depth and really get a good handle on some tricky and complicated issues. We'd like to start out by just generally going over what's new in Harrisburg. Obviously, you're now the Republican leader. The session has begun. The members have been sworn in. Committees have basically been assigned. Chairmen have been assigned. There have been a couple of changes in things from the last session, though. And the first big one is that we don't have as many Republican members this time as last time. How does that really kind of change the dynamic coming into what we're trying to achieve legislatively?
Well, thank you very much for that question and for noting some of the changes that have occurred here in Harrisburg. And I think that by and large, while there's always change, there's also opportunities. Specific to this area, you know, when you look at the current makeup of 110 members in our caucus, historically speaking, that is still very high when you look back over the last 50 to 75 years. One of the reasons it does not appear as high as it has, you know, we came from 121 members, so 110 certainly looks significantly less than that. But from a historical perspective, it's probably more in line with the high end and traditionally where the chamber has been for some time. And a lot of folks always assume that the majority really has been built on gerrymandering, which is simply not accurate. In fact, we as the Republican caucus hold 19 seats that have a Democratic voter registration edge. And that, to me, just fundamentally proves one of the things that I've always believed, which is that candidates and issues matter. And conversely, the Democrats also hold 10 seats that are majority Republican registration. So, you know, when it gets down to the nuts and bolts of the electoral process, the voters typically do, in fact, pick whomever they believe is the better candidate. So what that means from a policy makeup, though, really doesn't change. And I think in a lot of ways, my leadership style probably fits into the whole process the same, regardless of whatever the numbers and the makeups are. I think I've built a fairly objective and fair reputation on dealing with issues. When you look at many of the major issues that I've worked on legislatively, I think I'm well regarded by not only both political sides, Republican and Democrat, but also in both chambers, House and Senate. We always try to partner with individuals to advance many of the bigger issues, and I think that's very important.
Let's take a look at that a little bit here, and I was going to say one of the things you are kind of known for is making sure that bills that you want to achieve don't always come from the people that you necessarily expect them to come from. A lot of times they're coming from another party, another chamber, making sure that we're getting things done here in a bipartisan and bicameral way. Why is that important, and how does that make things a little bit more smooth when you're not pushing one agenda?
Well, I think that the first reason's self-evident, and that is the fact that I think the voters expect us to operate in that manner. There are some things, certainly, that fall more along ideological or partisan lines, and I think we all recognize that. But there are other issues which transcend any political registration. Property taxes is probably the one that comes to my mind the quickest, because it's an issue that is more geographically based than it is politically or party affiliation based. And you can see that in many of their votes because they tend to be geographically regional. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat. If you're from a certain area of the state, you are likely for property tax reform. And if you're not, then you're not. But I think that the voters' expectations are right on in this regard. You know, when you look at the numbers from last session, I think it's important to recognize that 93% of all the bills, and I just did an op-ed on this recently, 93% of all the bills had bipartisan support. Of those, 60% were unanimous that passed the House. And of those, nearly 50% got eventually signed into law. And the reason I believe that's important is because while the legislative process can be a little arduous at times, a little long, and a little frustrating, the truth is it traditionally produces some pretty good products, because items that make it out of the House and the Senate have a high likelihood of ultimately becoming law. And sometimes there's reasons why it doesn't. Most of the major issues that I've worked on in this manner have all taken more than one session. In fact, one issue that myself and Representative Pam DeLisio had worked on dealt with streamlining the hospital licensing process. It's one I've talked about extensively on many of the radio programs. However, when you look at that, the stakeholders had tried working on that issue for nearly three decades. And Representative DeLisio and myself were able to come in about 9 months, hammer out a compromise that kept everybody happy and accomplished what the goals were, which was moving our state inspectors from simply checking boxes and going through pro forma routines to focusing on complaints and allowing the federal accreditation process to issue what we termed a deemed license at the state level, because the federal process is actually a little more lengthy and involved, and therefore you're deemed to have also passed the state one at the same time. The reason that that is important is because we were behind on our complaint investigation, which directly impacts patient safety. So we were able to lessen the wait times for those investigations, the ones that I think we all would agree matter the most, improve patient safety, decrease cost, decrease the amount of time that individuals such as Pam and I, who had worked in these settings before, spent dealing with inspectors, because that meant we could focus more on taking care of patients. And that ultimately, I think, is what we care about as patients. When we go to the hospital, we want to have excellent care. We want to have access to that care. We want to have it quick. We want to have it cost effective. And we want high quality. And by changing all of the governmental paperwork that was required, we were able to accomplish all of those goals.
And that's a really good example of working in a bipartisan way to achieve things that really affect people in the Commonwealth, all across the Commonwealth, equally. I mean, we're talking about something that's medically driven and very important. Before we move on to more issues, I want to talk one more thing about the reconstruction of the and the structure of the House. There have been some rule changes that you guys implemented right as the session started. In fact, on opening day of the session, there were some votes on this. It was a little bit controversial. Talk to us about what changed in the rules, why you thought it was really important to do this, and why it was important to get it done now.
This particular issue is one that I've always worked on behind the scenes, but obviously given the new role of being the leader of the caucus and specifically the majority leader in the chamber, that put me at the forefront of this debate in terms of what changes could and should be made. Many in the press described it as the most substantive changes in over a decade to our rules, really since the pay raise and the Speaker's Reform Commission set of rules that were ultimately adopted. And that's very humbling, but the truth is it really was just things that needed to get done. We had several instances last session that dealt with issues of sexual harassment, criminal conduct, and really, in my opinion, thwarting the legislative process, all of which we address in those rules, and I'll take them individually now. You know, we had an instance where our ethics committee was not previously allowed to investigate complaints of sexual harassment. So we made that change in the rules, which I think will be very timely and important. They now have jurisdiction to hear those complaints. In terms of the criminal conduct, we had several members who were caught in a sting by the Attorney General, several of which pled guilty, one of which went to trial. And there were some issues because the Constitution is very clear about there are certain enumerated crimes regarding embezzling public money, perjury, you know, really crimes of what I would call honesty or crimes of moral character. And they're very specific that those crimes, convictions of those crimes, constitutionally prohibit you from serving. And there's been a series of case law that says, well, you're not actually convicted until you're sentenced. What we did was really streamline and expedited the process, because as a co-equal branch of government, while we have those court cases that are out there, the truth is we have jurisdiction over our own members so that we can set our own internal rules. And this is one of those cases. And so we updated the rules to expedite the consideration of expulsion resolutions upon conviction, that we wouldn't have to wait until sentencing. And I think that was a good improvement, and one that I think the voters overwhelmingly would support. And specific to the legislative process, probably the best example of this really was when you look at the reapportionment proposal that was voted out of the Rules Committee, one that I voted in support of. This was an issue that many of the outside organizations are very engaged on in terms of how the congressional districts and the state House and Senate districts are drawn. And, you know, I think it's a discussion that we should have. Unfortunately, there has kind of grown a practice where we call it ghost amendments, but essentially it's amendments that are in idea form only, not specific to written language or written proposals, are allowed to be filed. We prohibited that practice going forward because what happened with the redistricting bill was, you know, nearly 600 amendments were filed, 400 Democrat, 200 Republican. And what that ultimately did was thwart the consideration of the idea. And so we changed our rules to be more consistent with increasing the efficiency of the legislative process. And to be very clear, I do not believe that transparency and efficiency necessarily are exclusive. I think you can be both. I think we can be both transparent in the process in terms of filing, as well as efficient in getting ideas considered. And it's my hope that the changes that were put in the rules regarding the amendments and other things will give us that opportunity to more readily consider ideas without it being thwarted by an excessive number of really extraneous or unrelated amendments.
And let's move on a little bit to some legislation and some legislative ideas and topics. Let's first talk about a couple of things that made it through the legislative process last session with overwhelming bipartisan support in sometimes both the House and the Senate, but didn't quite make it over the finish line because the governor put his veto on them. The first is a piece of legislation that was House Bill 83 last session that dealt with responsible debt management. Talk to us a little bit about why this bill was important. What would we have achieved? How would we have gotten our debt situation in the state a little bit better under control? And maybe give us a little bit of insight into what the governor was thinking vetoing it. What could be done to get this across the finish line?
Well, regarding the governor's thoughts, I would certainly have to defer to him on that. I was somewhat perplexed by the veto. And as we revisit this issue, presumably in the next session, I think that will be one that we need to try to figure out what the real concern or the underlying issue was with the proposal. To simplify the proposal, it really is the idea that you pay both interest and principal on the money that the state borrows. Sometimes we essentially have balloon payments where you pay just the interest for a period of time and then it goes up rapidly at the end. And in those cases, that's just not good financial management for us here in the Commonwealth because you're really kicking the can down the road in terms of actually paying the bills. I think that that is an issue where the voters expect us to pay the bills that we owe. And that bill would have simplified and put into statute that process to ensure that the debt was paid off in a timely manner.
And this is the kind of thing that gets us into trouble, much like we've seen with the pension system and some other issues where we just don't have enough money going into the system or we're not paying our bills the right way. It gets the state into a little bit of trouble. And we don't want to end up in those kind of situations. Another thing that we'd like to talk about is a piece of legislation that also the governor vetoed that I know that's going to be coming back here soon, and that deals with career and technical education, workforce development, making sure that people in the state have the skills to work the jobs that are available today. Talk to us about the bill last year that we pushed through, the support that it had, the governor's veto, and what we might do this year in this session to move this forward.
Well, this is actually a bright spot for me personally because if you listen to the governor's comments on his swearing-in day, they echoed a lot of what I have talked about and what this chamber has focused on last session, which was workforce development and educational opportunities. I think that that's something that everybody recognizes is good public policy, but also it's important on the day-to-day operations of the Commonwealth and individual family budgets as well. For example, when you look at many of our fine institutions and the degrees that they're putting out, there's a disconnect. There's a very real disconnect between what the schools are producing in terms of degrees versus what the job market needs in terms of employee skills. And sometimes that's a four-year degree. Sometimes it's an associate's degree. Sometimes it's a technical or trade degree, all of which, I myself pursued. I started out in trade school and then eventually went to college and eventually went to law school. But I did it probably in what would be considered a very non-traditional route. I share that because I also remember when I told my guidance counselor that I was going to go to a trade school and not college, that somehow—
They looked at you like you had three heads and you were kind of crazy.
Well, her exact words were, you can't, you have to go to college. And part of that was because I was ranked very high in the class in terms of class rank. And the expectation, the societal expectation was that you go to college. And the truth is I think there's a wide variety of very great degrees and opportunities and jobs that are available without a full four-year college degree. and recognizing that some need it. You know, I would have never gotten into law school without a four-year college degree. That's a prerequisite. You're required to, and that's fine. But it's one decision that is probably, next to buying a home, going to be your single largest financial decision or impact on your future self that you will ever make. And if you don't go into that decision knowing what your likelihood of employability is, what the average student debt load is, what the salary is, all of this information, by the way, the government already collects. And not knowing what jobs you could even get with that degree, or more importantly, if you know there's a high demand job, what degree is needed to do that job? And these were things that we collected already, and we ran lots of reports on, but in order to make it usable, we need to get it out to the people. So that's why we included that provision in the education code last session and require this information to be shared publicly on the websites. And I think that will allow all of us, myself included, as a parent with someone in high school already, soon to be two, and having the access to that information will allow us to make better future career decisions as a family. And I think that that's important. Additionally, I think when you look at the opportunity and where the jobs really are, the reality is we're undergoing a huge shift, generationally speaking, as large numbers of individuals who have been gainfully employed in certain industries for long periods of time are readying for retirement. And, you know, I think of locally back home in Lancaster, Thaddeus Stevens, which is a great trade school, you know, they cannot produce enough welders out of their program to work with High Industries, which is a single industry, not the only industry in the county that uses welders. You know, I think they're going to need something like 900 new welders over the next 3 or 4 years. They can't produce them fast enough. And yet there's lots of other businesses that also need that same skill set. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, as these individuals retire, how do you replace that? Because that is a certain driver in terms of economic opportunity and development in our local region. Because if you can't hire the workers, you can't do the work.
And Brian, for those of us like you and me who grew up in rural environments, shout out to Solanco class of 1993, we saw a lot of our classmates at the time choose to go into technical trades, choose to go into agriculture, choose to do things that weren't going to college, but that's not the way people see it anymore. And especially in urban environments where people aren't exposed so much to some of the other careers, they see only what they see day to day, it might be a good idea to find some way to expose kids to other careers that might be out there and make sure that they know what kind of education they need to get there.
Well, and one of the issues that I encountered myself, and I'll be very honest, in my case, I happened to run track when I was in early high school. I was somewhat chronically injury prone. So I had a series of x-rays. I liked math and physics. My mom was a nurse, but I knew that I didn't want to be a nurse. And until I was a patient and interacted with the x-ray tech on a somewhat regular basis, asked him about what he did, why he did it, how he got involved in the field, what degree was used. It was really a career that I had not even anticipated on a personal level. Yet it was one that once I got into it, even to this day, I keep my x-ray license up. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But the truth is, it's a credential that I'm proud of that I earned and one that I want to keep and stay involved in that community. And those kinds of careers, sometimes you just need to be exposed to it in order to know that it even exists, because it matched up very nicely with my skill sets. I like helping people. I liked math. I liked physics, all of which you need in that job.
The next thing we'd like to talk about involves a really complicated issue, and this is venue shopping in medical malpractice lawsuits. This is something that had been addressed by the House a little bit more than 15 years ago, and ended up in the realm of the courts, and now some changes are being proposed, and this could really have a profound impact on the cost of healthcare. Can you frame this situation up and give us a good idea of what's going on, what could go wrong, and how we might address this?
One of the nice side benefits, if you will, of my background in healthcare was the fact that as I worked in x-ray and then radiology administration, and then eventually went to law school for healthcare law, I was focused on the policy impacts that the state regulations and proposals have on the healthcare industry. And one of the things that I encountered at the tail end of my own hospital career, and as I was getting ready to go to law school, was the medical malpractice crisis. That was something that I saw on a very real and personal basis. I saw physicians that were impacted by it. And what was happening at that time was, is you could have your surgery in Lancaster County, but if your physician was in any way related to a practice or a facility in Philadelphia, ultimately the lawsuit could potentially be filed in Philly, even though everything happened in Lancaster. And this is the legal term is venue in terms of where should the case be heard. And the practice of filing cases outside of where they occurred ultimately resulted in both legislative action as well as Supreme Court rulemaking that said, no, you have to file the case at the location of the injury.
And this is because it would really drive up insurance costs in certain places because you were more likely to get a favorable result if you tried the case in Philly.
Yeah, the history is that in Philadelphia, juries typically award more monetary damages and find guilt more often. And when you look at that, it had direct impact on the ability to practice medicine and the ability to get liability insurance. That's why Governor Rendell, is one of his first official acts, was he really pulled this council together that ultimately resulted in the MCARE Fund, which was for helping provide and offset liability insurance costs. And all of this was going on as I was entering law school. And what has come full circle now is the Supreme Court has recently taken up a rule adoption process. And keep in mind that our statute has never officially been invalidated, but they're looking at changing the rule that the Supreme Court operates under. And my fear is should that occur, that you would go right back to where we were a dozen or 15 years ago with struggling to find doctors in high malpractice areas, such as OBGYN with the delivery of babies, orthopedic or neurological surgeries. You know, these high medical malpractice cost areas would see a direct impact on not just their insurance premiums, but the costs that are associated with running their practices, as well as increased liability. And I think that the current venue rule and statute both adequately addressed the issue that was before us, which said that, you know, as a matter of standard, you deserve to have a jury of your peers from the area where the injury actually occurred and is more likely to find a result that is more consistent with the area that you're from. And I think that as we go forward, this will be an issue that comes up early in this legislative cycle. And it's one that the discussions will be ongoing, both with the court as well as constituents, about the actual and real impact that could have on the access to care, because that is and should be one of our primary concerns. A change in this area has the potential to impact access. It has an impact to quality as well, because if you can't find a physician that practices in your area, your quality of care could be different, and or the impact on you as a personal individual in terms of how far you have to travel could also be different. And finally, it will absolutely impact costs. So all of those factors will be taken into consideration as we go forward. But it is one that I think will come up very early on in this legislative session.
When you're looking to address this issue, obviously you mentioned that this is a court decision that they're looking to change the way this goes. Is this something that dovetails in with some of the legislation and the efforts that you've been making as far as selection of judges, judicial districts? Is this something that we need to make sure that the people making the decisions in this, that the judges are thinking about all areas of the state when they're making these decisions?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, one of the issues that you have is that nearly two-thirds of all of the justices come from two counties, that being Philadelphia and Allegheny. I've argued, and that's why I've always supported merit selection as an aside, because I don't believe that your geographical base or your name identity or money should necessarily dictate. I don't believe they're good indicators of who makes a good judge and who doesn't. You know, obviously, the Senate, I would offer, found the same concern because they offered a slightly different solution. They went with the judicial district's proposal. The good news is I think we both recognize that there's an issue. The unfortunate part was we weren't able to arrive at a solution. So I think as we go forward with that, I think it is important to recognize the impact. It's always easy to become a little centered on your area where you're from and just assume that it's like that everywhere in the state. And I think that that's something to keep in mind as we go forward on any legislative issue, not just this one.
Brian, thanks for being my guest today, and we'll tackle some more issues on our next podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler.